Hello everyone, welcome to our first episode of Doctor and Me podcast show. I'm super excited today to have Dr. Jeffrey Bush with me. My name is Naren and I'm your host. Dr. Jeffrey Bush is the founder of LegacyMaleHealth.com. One way to reach him is to go to his website, which is called VasectomyReversalDoctor.com. Dr. Bush, welcome. Welcome to Doctor and Me podcast show.
Thank you, Naren. It's a pleasure to be with you and the audience today.
Thank you, Doctor. For those of us who don't know much about you, can you kind of tell us a little bit about yourself? Tell us your story. Why didn't you get into medicine?
It stemmed from a curiosity with science and the human body at an early age, and seeming to have an aptitude for pursuit of knowledge in the field of science and biology.
So when did you go to medical school, Doctor?
I graduated from the University of Michigan's medical school in 1980, quite a while back.
Right. So you've been practicing medicine for, let me do my math, 37 years.
Well, yep, and the practicing is never over. There's always room for improvement.
I love that approach. So you're always learning, always a kid again, kind of exploring new things.
Yep, always tinkering to get better results for my patients.
That's awesome. So you're always, of course, on the cutting edge, right? I mean, you're always trying new techniques and looking what other doctors are doing and seeing how you can learn and grow.
Absolutely. I'm probably my own worst critic.
Right. And like you said, you love science, so you do it because it's fun for you. You get into the science of it and why?
Not even just the science, but it's the human element, the personal nature to it. As time has gone on, I valued the human interaction and the personal nature of what I do, I would think, even more than the science.
That makes sense. Can you tell me how you got into men's health? Like, what motivated you to kind of get more and more involved in this? And can you tell us your journey?
Yeah, it's a bit of a long and winding journey. I started out, I always knew that I wanted to have a mix of both medical aspects of the practice, diagnosis, treating with medications, educating my clients, but also enjoyed aspects of surgery. I couldn't decide on a specific surgical specialty at first, and it was during my internship year that urology found me. And within my urology training, the field of male reproduction found me, because I realized in the early 80s that the people who were at the top of that field, scientifically, not many of them really had a great scientific foundation, and so the opportunity plus the interest in male reproduction, which had challenging problems both diagnostically, medically, and surgically, was very appealing to me.
Right. And when we talk about male reproduction, I mean, I'm blessed, thank God, with two daughters, and I love my daughters. One is 14 and one is 11. Me and my wife, I don't know what our life would have been like without our kids. So I bet not everybody has that good fortune, and probably there are a lot of people out there, you know, who need your help.
Yeah, it's estimated that about one out of every six couples who's trying to conceive is having trouble. But certainly, we also help people who are feeling like, hey, I've got enough kids, I'm ready to control the situation now, so we do vasectomies. And then when they change their mind about it and find themselves in a new relationship or feel like they cut it short and want to have more kids in the same relationship, we even do a number of microsurgical vasectomy reversals, which is both an art and a science unto itself.
Right. Tell me a little bit more about this one out of six couples who are struggling to have a child.
Yeah, the statistics go like this. About 80 to 85% of all couples who are trying to conceive will end up conceiving by the end of 1 year. But if you take a look at what would happen in that second year to the 15 to 20% of couples that did not conceive on their own in year one, only 30% of those couples will get pregnant on their own in year two without medical assistance. And once a woman is hitting into age 35 and beyond, where she starts losing her fertility at a more rapid rate, then we start investigating infertility at 6 months of trying without success.
Right. So you're saying 15 to 20% of couples who are trying to have a child are not able to. Is that like high compared to historical numbers, or is that pretty standard? I mean, if you look at the last few hundred years.
Well, you know, it's a recent science. So the data really stems more from like 1950 onward.
Right.
And realistically, it hasn't changed a lot from what I've come across in the past two decades.
I see. But why are these families struggling, to have a child? I mean, what are typically the reasons why they're struggling?
Well, the number one thing on the female side is an ovulation issue or an inflammatory condition of the pelvis unrelated to infection, something called endometriosis. On the male side, the number one diagnosable condition is something called varicocele, varicose veins of the testicles, which causes overheating of the testicles. And this is present in probably about 50 to 60% of the general male infertility part of my practice. Other reasons might include infection or vasectomy-related blockages in the sperm ducts, which can then be treated with microsurgery in the scrotum sac that holds the testicle to bypass these blockages.
Right.
In a large percentage, however, which it's difficult to determine, we are increasingly finding that as opposed to hormone-related issues, which is a smaller subsegment, in probably a third of cases, it can be genetically determined. Now, everyone thinks of inherited when they think of their genetics, but an increasing prevalent model of how we conceptualize genetic flaws of different organs in the body is one of a spontaneous genetic mutation. For people who don't know what that means, it's that at some point after dad's sperm and mom's egg combined to create each one of us in mom's womb in the uterus, multitude of DNA replication cycles are ongoing. And at some point, if a flaw in the replication of the DNA, let's say in this case controlling function of the testicle and production of sperm, if a flaw occurs and it doesn't get recognized by the normal monitoring mechanism for flaws in DNA replication, so it doesn't get recognized, or maybe it doesn't get repaired by the normal DNA repair mechanisms, then that individual is left with perpetual replication of flawed DNA controlling a key organ system, in this case, male reproduction. Did that make sense to you, Naren?
I think I need to break it into pieces. I mean, you know so much, and I know probably 1,000th of what you know, so I think... So let's take it step by step. So, of course, you focus on male you don't help females, you only focus on males, right, who are struggling with
Right, but
reproduction.
in order to do it well, you have to understand a good deal of what goes on the female side. Not that I treat it, but in order for me to coordinate with my collaborating OBGYN and reproductive endocrinologist colleagues.
I understand. So there's a lot of teamwork between you and the OBGYN.
Absolutely.
Right. And how long have you been doing this? I mean, working with doctors who work on the
Oh,
female health.
since 1985. So I finished my formal training in urology with my focus primarily in male reproduction since 1985.
Right. Let's take one by one. So you said, what's the number one cause of male reproduction challenges for couples who are trying to conceive?
Yeah, a condition in men called varicocele or varicose veins of the testicles. And it's not something that a man would necessarily see on the outside, but something that an experienced doctor would diagnose in a clinic visit with the man standing and doing a careful visual and digital examination of the scrotum and testicle and sperm ducts.
Got it. So varicose vein of the testicle. Break it down for us. I didn't go to medical school, so tell me, why does it affect my chances of having a child?
Okay, so varicose veins, whether it's in your legs or your testicles, occur because of a faulty valve system in the veins in a given part of the body. The valve system is supposed to let blood go to the heart, but it's also supposed to keep blood from backing up. When the valve malfunctions and allows blood to back up, in this case toward the testicle, it causes overheating of the testicle. And pretty much anyone who's surfed the internet or read the Ladies' Home Journal knows that heat is supposed to be bad for sperm formation. So in this case, this condition comes on during puberty as the man is growing from adolescence into adulthood and as the testicle increases its blood supply and its size. And so what we will see is that if you take a group of men who develop varicocele and you follow a group mean over their adult years, in general, that group has declining fertility from puberty onwards as compared to a group of men without this condition.
Got it. Now, so that affects production of good quality sperm, if I may kind of summarize it as far as I understood it.
Sure.
Right. And
What we see in the semen analysis, which is the gold standard of assessing a man's fertility, which is sperm count, sperm movement, or what we call motility, and the sperm morphology or shape score, which is a predictor of egg penetrating ability of the sperm, any one of those or all of them can be affected. So the overheating from the varicocele is one thing, but the other item which creates the individual difference from man A to man B to man C is what that person's genetically determined robustness of fertility was. So in other words, if you have a man with supernormal genetic fertility and you have varicoceles, it does not impact his fertility. Whereas if you have a man with average genetic fertility or slightly less, and then you add the overheating from the varicocele, that pushes that gentleman into a low fertility category.
Right. So you examine the patient, and you can probably figure out if this person has varicocele, right? The varicose veins. And
Yeah.
then you also do the test, sperm test, just to make sure to
Yeah, absolutely. And we can't go by a single sperm test. So generally, we need at least two separated by 3 to 4 weeks in time to assess for a gentleman's variation over time. And when you have two semen exams that look relatively different, then we need a third semen exam as a tiebreaker, if you will.
Right. Now, for the semen exam, do I have to come and see you in person, or how does that work?
No, we have an independent sperm testing laboratory that will accept patients who refer themselves, doctor referrals from OBGYNs, primary care doctors, and it also includes my own patients who I'm already seeing.
Right. Do you have patients who would send in their sperm to you without actually coming to see you?
Yeah, so we will get contacted via email or via the telephone by people who actually don't know a doctor to go to. They find us on the internet or by word of mouth in many cases, and just know that we represent the highest quality sperm testing as well as male reproductive diagnosis and treatment area in the Dallas-Fort Worth region.
Right. Now, once you find somebody has varicocele, like, how do you treat it?
Well, we don't necessarily have to treat the varicocele. And the approach that I take with gentlemen, because the classic treatment is with a minor day surgery, fixing the veins not close to the testicle, but a few inches higher in the low groin area, so that it seems not just so that it seems less threatening to the poor guys, but also because that's a better spot for a variety of technical and safety reasons to do it. So it's a day surgery to fix it. And if you go to an expert like myself, as opposed to a general urologist who treats everything from incontinence to kidney stones to prostate disorders, if you go to someone who's a specialist, you will have as high as a 70% chance for getting significant improvement in the semen exam and a tripling or more of your baseline fertility level.
Tripling or more of your baseline fertility level. Explain that to me, please.
Right. I'm glad you asked. So many of the guys who come in to see me, if you recall earlier in the conversation, may have a 30% or less chance to get pregnant per year. Many of my clients, based on the semen exam, only have a 15 to 20% chance to get pregnant per year. After you correct the varicoceles, if they are in the 70% out of my own practice, these are my statistics that improve, the pregnancy rate will go as high as 80%, which is consistent with the norm.
Meaning the average human being. And if I go to a urologist who's not a specialist like you, do you think would it be similar or would it be less? And what are the differences?
Well, in many cases, they don't do the exam properly to make the correct diagnosis. Since someone with my level of expertise is only a member of the training programs in 10% of the training programs around the country, so many of the urologists in the country have never had exposure to proper male infertility training. So, number one, they might miss the diagnosis. Number two, when they go in to do the surgery, they typically tie off one or two veins rather than fixing every single vein. And since even the small varicose veins communicate with the big ones, if they don't capture and treat each single abnormal vein, big or small, you'll have a high persistence of varicocele rate and a failure to improve. So, in my experience, when a general urologist corrects varicoceles, there can be as high as a 50% rate of persistence of the varicocele after what the patient is hoping is a corrective surgery.
Right.
When it comes to the chances of having a persistent varicocele when I or an expert like myself does it, it's only 2%.
That makes sense. And that's just because you have been doing this for such a long time and you really, really specialize in this.
Absolutely.
Now, when it comes to the next major cause of male reproduction issues, what is that?
Okay. So it falls off quite a bit from there, and there may be hormone issues, which can be diagnosed from a blood test and potentially treated with medication, or it may be that someone's had a surgery, a vasectomy, for instance, and wants to have it reversed, or they could have had an infection in the sperm ducts that created a blockage. So a variety of different blockages. Less common than that is where, as a boy, the boy may have had failure of the testicle to descend into the scrotum sac, what they call undescended testis. And there seems to be a genetic link to infertility in those cases, even when that testicle is brought down into the scrotum sac at a young age. But I think the second biggest category, Naren, is frankly this what we used to call idiopathic. As I like to joke, it means us doctors were idiots because we couldn't figure out why the couple couldn't get pregnant, or what was called unexplained infertility or unexplained abnormal semen exam. And I think in many of those cases, it's a genetic flaw, what I had alluded to earlier, from a spontaneous genetic mutation in the DNA regulating sperm count, movement, and sperm quality as produced.
So genetic flaw meaning genetically they are not capable of having a child, and just because something happened in the way they're...
That's a great question. It's very seldom an all or none situation where either you can or you cannot have a child unless you have zero sperm. If you have zero sperm, you cannot have a child. But any time a guy has any sperm at all, he is going to have some chance to get pregnant on a spectrum from 0 to 100%. And so that's why you have to look at fertility as a spectrum of probabilities of getting pregnant.
Right. I understand. Makes sense. Should we talk about... vasectomy reversal or hormone? Which do you think is the next?
Oh, I think vasectomy reversal would be a great topic, and then the hormones third, and I think that would probably give us plenty of information for people.
Right. So let's talk about vasectomy reversal, and tell us the human side of this. Why do patients come? I mean, of course, they had a vasectomy, and why are they coming back to get it reversed? So what do you see? I mean, how long have you been doing vasectomy reversals, doctor?
Yes, started doing them during my training in the early 1980s in upstate New York. So the most common, of course, is the classic situation. A man has children with one woman, the marriage ends in divorce, the guy had a vasectomy at the time prior to the divorce because he was done having as many children as he wanted with that wife, and then, never thinking he was going to be divorced and remarried, suddenly he finds himself in that exact situation, often with a woman who has had no children of her own in his second marriage, and for the sake of her being able to feel complete in her life and become a mother, he often will say, you know what, I really do love you enough that I'm considering having this done so that we can have our family together.
Right.
That's the situation about 80% of the time where a couple wants to have kids together, and sometimes the woman already in this day and age has children from a prior marriage herself. So we have even blended families where he has kids from another marriage, she has children from another marriage, and they just want to have their one or two children together. But in 20% of cases, it's a couple who may have one or two children, maybe even three, felt overwhelmed or thought they were done, and then decides, wait a second, we stopped too short and we want to have more kids in the same marriage. So that's about 20% of couples pursuing vasectomy reversal.
I know you've been doing a lot of these cases. Do you know approximately how many of these vasectomy reversal cases you've done in the last 30 plus years?
Best guess is several thousand. It's something I don't keep an exact track of, but early in my career, I was, say, doing one a week, and throughout most of my career, it's been two or three vasectomy reversals per week.
People come and see you for this from around the state and even sometimes in from other states, correct?
Sure. In fact, today I did a reversal just today on a gentleman who works as a contractor providing valuable support for military surveillance in Afghanistan. And he came in, visited his brother, went to his nephew's graduation from a college in Boston, flew into Dallas, had his vasectomy reversal, and he'll be heading to visit family in San Antonio and then heading back to work in Afghanistan in about 10 days.
Wow. How long does it take and how does it work?
It takes about 3 to 4 hours, including setup time, depending on the complexities of the individual case. What's done is after the gen it's an outpatient surgery. Once the gentleman is put to sleep because of time duration, not because of discomfort, we numb him up with a bunch of long-acting Novocaine, and it's a small 1-inch cut on each side of the scrotum sac. We access the vas deferens and free up tissue with good blood supply and cut on either side of the prior interruption in the vas deferens, and then under microscopic control, after we verify that there's sperm in the fluid coming from the testicle side of the vasectomy, we can do a straightforward microsurgical reconnect. Now, a lot of men want to know, why isn't microsurgery? Because the vasectomy wasn't. The rationale is that the outer size of the vas tube is the size of a linguine noodle, but the inner tube of the vas, which has a relatively thick muscular wall, is the diameter of a fine point on a fine point pen. So, in order to get that level of approximation, you need to do it under a microscope to get the best healing and best possible success rates. So then it is carefully hand-stitched using tiny needles, tiny suture that you can't see with your naked eye in order to get a very watertight, accurate reapproximation. And care is also needed to be sure there's no tension on the reconnection and that each side of the fresh cut end of the vas has a good blood supply. The trickier part is in the subset of cases where back pressure or an infection behind the vasectomy has created a secondary blockage closer to the testicle in the even tinier duct called epididymis. In those cases, it's signified by finding only sperm parts, no complete sperm in the vas fluid, or only fluid and not even sperm parts. And in that case, then we need to bypass to this tinier, more delicate epididymis tube closer to the testicle. There are very few doctors who hold themselves out as specialists in vasectomy reversal who have learned to successfully do that more delicate procedure, which I've learned to do on a very routine basis.
Tell me about success rate. I'm sure you do track your success rate, correct, doctor, with vasectomy reversal?
Yes. So success rate is measured two ways. One is, of course, in return of sperm, which is a technical success. But what the couple's looking for is bringing home that newborn baby to join the rest of the family. And so pregnancy and live birth rates are the true measure by which couples are going to look at this. If we are able to do a straightforward vasectomy reversal, regardless of whether the gentleman is 1 year removed from the vasectomy or 20 years removed, in my hands, if we're able to do the straightforward microsurgical reconnect on both sides, he will be 99% for returning sperm. So long as his wife is age 35 or younger, their pregnancy rates, from my experience, are going to be averaging close to 70%, even higher when the wife is younger. For couples where we have to connect to the epididymis on both sides, we're looking more at success rates of 55 to 60% in terms of pregnancy and live birth.
It's amazing. So 99% for pretty standard cases, right? I mean, when it comes to the sperm.
Right. And in the most difficult cases in my hands, when we have to bypass to the epididymis on both sides, we're running 85% for returning sperm.
It's amazing. And that's perhaps because of the amount of experience you have, or is there anything different that you do that others don't?
It's experience, it's surgical technique, it's anticipating things in the patient's history indicating like prior infections that they may have had, in which case I might start them on preventive antibiotics. And then it's follow-up, because in a lot of cases, unless the doctor is monitoring at periodic intervals in the first year after the reversal and looking for a normal, say, progression to normal fertility, then the doctor can be missing an indirect indication of scar reaction at the microsurgical level. So in other words, if the man is supposed to be hitting certain trajectory of sperm improvement over time, and he's failing to do so, we imply that he must have a low level of scar reaction going on, preventing him from reaching his normal landmarks at a given time. And if that's the case, then I can institute some additional medication treatment with antibiotics and anti-inflammatories to improve that individual outcome.
It looks like you are really, really focused on getting people pregnant again, right? So at the end of the day, till that happens, you're not a happy man. So you work with the OBGYN.
No, I mean, I'm relatively happy with getting sperm back, but our real goal is to see our couples smiling, holding a baby in their arms.
Right, right. And that involves a lot more than just getting sperm back. That involves working with the OBGYN, that involves treating other things and staying with the patient.
Absolutely. It's all in the details.
It's all in the details. I love it. Let's talk about the role of hormones and how that may affect fertility.
This is probably the fastest growing area of male reproductive health right now. And not that I'm a big fan of all these low testosterone clinics, but just like the TV commercials for Viagra and Cialis and Levitra and now one called Stendra have helped make it easier for men to discuss sexual function and it's acceptable to get it diagnosed and treated, there's so much going on now with men looking at trying to stay younger and healthier longer into their adult years. And so a lot of men have been looking at, gosh, I'm dragging butt lately. Maybe I ought to get my testosterone level checked.
Right, right. So this is more of a, this is not surgery, right? This is, you treat them over a period of time. How does this work?
Yeah, this is medication treatment. Unfortunately, what we've learned is once a guy's testicles stop manufacturing testosterone at the levels they should be making testosterone, and the gentlemen are suffering with low energy, easy fatigability, no interest in their wife or partner, other symptoms of low testosterone include a mental fuzziness, not feeling sharp with high-level mental function, short-term memory, and even in some men feeling a little bit depressed or lacking motivation. So these are all things that result in changes in metabolism, putting on weight, and it's been referred to even as the metabolic syndrome. So when guys start noticing these things, they will check in with their primary care doctor, their urologist, or someone like myself, or even these low testosterone clinics, and it's very easy to make a diagnosis of what's going on with a blood test. But unfortunately, once this goes bad, it's going to require lifelong treatment with rare exception, because once it goes wrong, it doesn't seem to self-correct.
Interesting. So when you say once it goes bad, you mean the low T, the amount of testosterone is not being produced at the sufficient quantity, you have to keep getting that for life.
Yeah, you have to do some sort of hormone, let's call it testosterone augmentation therapy, because if a gentleman needs to maintain their fertility and you give that gentleman testosterone, it will shut down a gland in the brain called the pituitary gland, which is normally needed to stimulate sperm production in the testicles. So if a man no longer needs kids, testosterone replacement therapy is absolutely what you want to do. But if a man needs to maintain sperm production, there's a much more sophisticated way that you have to do it to get the testicles to produce more testosterone in a sperm-friendly manner. And this is something that's poorly understood by the doctors at these low T centers, poorly understood by most urologists, and not understood at all by primary care doctors who, in my experience, will often, without knowing any better, tell the patients that, oh, don't worry, this is not only good for your testosterone level, but this testosterone is going to make your sperm better, stronger, and more of them. And nothing could be further from the truth.
Right. Now, how do people pay for this? Does insurance pay for any of this?
Yeah, in many cases, insurance will pay for the diagnosis and the treatment of male hormone dysfunctions. And
right.
Even for patients who are cash pay, they can have pretty cost-effective treatment that won't cost them more than about $30 a month.
That's pretty amazing. $30 a month. So that's, you know, that's very affordable for most people. That's like, you know, going to Starbucks, I guess, what, once a week?
Could be.
Let me ask you this. So insurance, does it pay for any other type of treatment we have been talking about so far?
Yeah, so many of the men who, although they come in to see me for fertility issues and have the varicocele, many of the men also have testicular discomfort. And so we can legitimately, in those cases, say to the insurance company that, you know, this gentleman has testicular discomfort and varicocele correction is indicated to help with his symptoms.
Right. By the way, what is testicular discomfort?
Often men who have the varicoceles will feel a heaviness or an almost squeezing sensation on the testicles. I don't know about you, but that seems uncomfortable to me.
Right, right. Absolutely. Let me ask you this. I was just browsing your website, and I see this section that talks about money-back guarantee, and it's under your vasectomy reversal section. What is that?
Right. Well, one of the things that we do, because it's impossible for the discriminating client to look at myself or other doctors who claim to be experts at vasectomy reversal and know whether we are truly being honest about our success rates. I see it all the time where doctors I know are not getting the success rates they claim to be getting, are advertising that they get these 99% success rates with reversing vasectomy. So we've been using since 2003, so now it's 14 years that I've been offering a money-back guarantee program on my surgeon fee portion of the vasectomy reversal as it relates to getting sperm back.
Right,
so
right.
If a man is less than 10 years from the time of his vasectomy to the time of his vasectomy reversal, and he does all the proper follow-up and fails to get sperm to come back, he gets my entire surgeon fee back. If a man is 10 or more years out and fails to get sperm to come back after his reversal, I will give him half of my surgeon fee back.
That's amazing. You're that confident that it's going to work. I guess 99%, right?
Well, so I study my numbers, and I'm willing to put my own livelihood where my advertised success rates are.
Right. Makes ton of sense. I think for the next episode, what are some of the topics you think we should talk about?
Let's see. I think one of the topics would be the element of fear and men coming to the doctor for male reproductive problems of all sorts.
Interesting. They are afraid to come and see you?
What are the fears? Which ones are justified? Which ones are unjustified? And how do we minimize the reasons to be afraid?
Right, right. And you do treat other types of erectile dysfunction, for example. That's one of the things you treat, correct?
Right.
There's a lot of stuff I think we can talk about. Any final words for the men listening or even couples listening to this? That if, let's say, they are struggling with conceiving a child, what would your advice be to them?
The main advice is that knowledge is power, and unfortunately, so many clients have spent years with doctors whose non-expert opinion they trusted and felt that nothing further could be done. And then they finally come to see me trying to give it one last try. And it breaks my heart as well as theirs that my chance to help those people would have been even better if I had seen them early on. And the same thing happens when I've had a patient who tried to save money going to the cheapest person to do the vasectomy reversal, and then they come to me once they had a failed vasectomy reversal. And although I'll still have excellent success rates in many of those cases, we would have had even better success if they had come to me first. So one of my missions is to try to get as many people early on in their pursuit of fertility, or all male reproductive cases, if not to me, then to someone at my level who can give them their best chance for success.
Right. And so when people come to see you from out of state, typically do they stay there for a few days, or how does it work? Do they need
Yeah,
to?
they'll come in, say if they're coming in for a vasectomy reversal, we do free telephone consultations ahead of time with local as well as distant people, and get all their questions answered so that they can feel comfortable enough to come in, do an in-person consultation physical exam with me late in the afternoon, the day prior to their surgery, do the surgery the next morning, stay overnight, and then head back on an airplane out of town 24 hours after their surgery, feeling relatively comfortable.
Amazing. So you make it easy for them also when they come in. So it's as
We
efficient as possible.
are all about client service.
Right.
And so I think another topic that would be a great topic is that because I don't participate in insurance, I've been very aggressive and flexible in terms of incorporating telemedicine into my practice.
That's excellent. So instead of me driving or flying in and spending hours or even, half an hour to come and see you, I could,
Well,
how does that work?
Or let's say I've got an infertility patient or a low testosterone patient who has to move out of town across the country because of a change in jobs. It used to be I'd have to find them a next best doctor wherever they move to. But now I've developed, since I've got 30 plus years experience doing what I do, I've developed a confidence and comfort level that I can continue to manage them with telemedicine remotely.
Right. So how does it work? Is it video or is it like a phone call? How long are these calls? How
Yeah,
does it set it
it's
up?
a phone call, and it's just as if I was seeing the person in my office at the same time. Because very rarely do I really need to do a physical exam for an established patient who I'm managing for a chronic situation. And if there is something, he can get examined by his PCP locally. So usually it's just managing verbal input from what's going on in their life, any symptoms they're having, any complicating medical issues, what's going on with your height and weight, has any other doctor changed your medications, have you had any surgeries since the last time we visited, and then it's whatever blood laboratories are appropriate to their situation, and then we can make whatever recommendations we make. One of the attitudes that I've been an early leader in is the patient being a partner with me in their care, and me really being their advisor, their guide.
So I like the way you put it. You said the patient is your partner and you are their coach slash guide. So it's teamwork.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And when we do it that way, I rarely have a problem with patient compliance.
Right.
When we involve the patient as a partner in orchestrating their own care, they have such this feeling of involvement and recognizing that they have to take an active role in their getting better and staying healthy.
So they're committed to it because they are partners, as opposed to they're a participant or, you know, passive person just being there.
Exactly. And if I'm prescribing hormone medications, for instance, and if they're out of compliance with blood testing, which they should know, and I remind them, is for their own safety, not just for me to be in compliance, then I won't renew the medication until we're back in compliance and have the proper lab testing to keep it safe. And whereas some other doctors might find patients feeling disgruntled or, you know, feeling like I'm holding them hostage to their medication, my patients understand and they're accepting and they say, okay, doc, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. I fell off the wagon.
And is that because you spend a lot of time on educating them and like spending a lot of time? And then you talked about, you know, you really got into
absolutely. The other advantage I have with not participating in insurance is that if a patient has a 15-minute scheduled consultation with me or a 30-minute scheduled consultation with me, they're spending all that time talking with me, the doctor, not talking with a medical assistant or some other intermediary healthcare provider, and then maybe only seeing the doctor for 30 or 60 seconds during an in-person visit. So the patient, from my perspective, even though they're paying a full cash price and having to submit to their insurance for reimbursement, they're getting terrific quality time.
I know the feeling. I once went to see an ophthalmologist, and it was like a mill. And, you know, it took me 2 hours, but I literally talked to the doctor for less than 45 seconds. But
yeah,
I was just
and this is what's happening in the general insurance-covered or even national healthcare plans. They're trying to turn healthcare into a commodity, and the best healthcare is not delivered as a commoditized service. The best healthcare is delivered by making a personal connection between the healthcare provider and the person who's the healthcare consumer in a partnership. And that's the attitude and approach that we bring to the table.
Makes sense. So the patient is educated, they're part of the solution, they are working with you, they're compliant. And so everything goes up. The chance of success goes up. Safety goes up. Everything goes up.
And satisfaction goes up.
Right, because they're part of it. They kind of had something to do with that outcome.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I like joking around with my patients after a vasectomy or after a surgical procedure. I like to let them know how smoothly everything went. So if something goes wrong, it's because they didn't do their part. I've learned that when I tell them that, they're also going to be more likely to comply with the recommended post-operative care.
Right. And when it comes to post-operative care, do you stay in touch with them? How does that work?
Sure. So the other thing that I allow my patients to do too is that if they are supposed to have a 10 to 14 day post-operative visit, if everything is going smoothly and they have no question, we do it as a phone consult. But if they have anything that they feel requires me to examine them in person, absolutely, they just show up.
Thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Bush. This is a wonderful conversation. I really, really enjoyed it, and I want to have this conversation again with you, but hopefully we'll get into some of the other topics we talked about today in terms of fear and how that plays a role, and also a lot of the other things you treat in making men and their lives a little bit better with your focus on men's health.
Thank you, Naren. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you. Once again, everyone, thank you for listening to another episode of Doctor and Me podcast show.